among thousands of men, but one strives for perfection. Even of the perfected that strive, but one knows me in truth.
Even of the perfected that strive?
Yes, this is me.
Father would be perfect.
No, even of the perfected that strive.
Oh, there must be a transmitting a term there that means rational, I think, isn't it?
City, they call it.
City. Oh, that's the term, we can see why. Put a lot of ticks on the paper and it represents a lot of people. Of all the people we represent with this ticks on the paper, not one of them strive for perfection. Since it's quite obvious that the millions of people that we do know don't strive for perfection at all. In fact, most of them don't strive at all in any way, because striving implies the application of effort over time, some sort of directional sense. Most people don't have a directional sense and don't strive. In fact, it appears to be quite technical about the word people. As we said before, the word people means knee benders or sexually determined. And these people as such, move along lines of least resistance determined by pleasure and pain. And sexual impulses are at the back of every motive they have. And that is the proper definition of the word people. So that if we say there is a pyramid in the world, and the top brick of this pyramid should not be represented, as in the Great Pyramid it was not. The top brick there represents the infinite, the Allah for letter A. And immediately below this is the line for all those people who are cosmically conscious. But immediately we say people, we've said knee benders. Now these who are cosmically conscious bend the knee to the principle of Logos. They actually believe that reason is inherent in the universe, and they bend the knee to reason. The Greek word logos means ratio, and if you remember that the letter L is like a triangle and the letter G is like a triangle, and we surround it with the O's and the S, we have a system of two wheels, one inside the other, and these two wheels represent the physical body and the subtle body, your material and your idea body, and coming out of the center of it is the S, which means spirit. This spirit, as transcendent, is called spirit and is free, and as involved in identification with the body, either the gross material body or the subtle body of the ideas, is called soul. Soul is spirit identified with a finite body, whether that body is a gross material body or a subtle body of ideas. As soon as one bends the knee, even to logic, the knee is bent. But the people who bend the knee to pure logic are released from bending the knee to lower order things. Now, right at the bottom, we can have those that bend the knee physically in the act of copulation. They're the physical knee benders. They're called knee benders because most sexual intercourse in the animal posture was, of course, using the bent knee. And those of you who've seen by the waysides in darkest India and elsewhere, gentlemen putting their little carts on one side, when they have a cookie, you'll see them bending the knee. So that those who actually bent the knee physically became the type of knee benders. So if we cover the bottom row of the pyramid with a lot of bricks, with little drawings of men with their knees bended, and they're all busy with their girlfriends. They are bending the knee to the physical impulse. Now, immediately above this level are the men who do not bend the knee to that, but they bend the knee to the idea that there are powerful men above them who can order them about. The, suppose when we say the bottom row is the labouring class, the workers, they mean to work, not because they want to, they don't want to. They would much rather have girlfriends. But because they're orientated towards girlfriends, by the threat of castration, they are kept at work. Now, immediately above them are the commercialists and the clerks, who don't want to be castrated and have sufficient intelligence to realize that if they can use their heads and learn reading, writing and arithmetic, they can act as mediators between power men and the knee bends. So in the bureaucracy we find a lot of people who wouldn't like to be caught doing naughty deeds in an open field at the back of whatever it is, in any particular town, whether it's Chaltonville or what is it, Sefton Park there? In each town there's a particular zone which is famous for this knee bending activity, and immediately above this level there's a level we would call the middle class of clerks and lower commercialists. And above them are the individual men who are fond of saying that they're self-made, and they mean that they feel an individual sense of striving within themselves to give orders. They tend to give orders to other people, either to clerks or to knee-benders. And of course above this level of the tough individual man are the men who say the individual man himself is subject to cosmic law, and this we call the priests. Let's write them down here. Priests, shall we call them hetmen here? They would be called warriors in the Bhagavad Gita term. The priests are the Brahmins. The hetmen are the warriors, the tough fellows who are prepared to fight for it. And below them are the commercialists, the bureaucrats. And below them are workers. Now all these are circumscribed. Beyond them is something which is nothing. The undefined, the infinitely unlimited. We have a fourfold caste system here. We can see it in Greece. We can see it in the same period in Egypt, and we can see it in India, formulated very clearly as caste system. It is based on the fourfold structure of an individual human being. An individual human being is pitched either in nervous energy or intellect or feeling or physical body. These are the four orientations. So when we build our pyramid, if we like, we leave the top of the count because that represents the infinite, and we divide this part into four layers, and in the bottom we put the workers, who are also the knee benders, and above those we put the clerks and the shopkeepers, anybody who keeps the wheels of industry turning without making decision, without making initiative. And above them, the headmen who make the individual decisions, and above them, the priests who claim to be acting in the name of the Creator or universal reason. Now they're all bending the knee to something. The priests are bending the knee to this cosmic logos. In Chaldea they studied astronomy, called it astrology in Greece, that they meant by astrology what today is meant by astronomy, and they claimed that they had authority to give orders to everybody, no matter how tough as individuals they were. Individual strongmen consulted the priests to get information about the probability that something would happen within the solar cycle. The priest knew when the Nile was going to flood. They had astronomical observatories, and they knew exactly by star measurements when the year had completed itself. Individual strongmen consulted the priests, paid the priests for the information, and then used the information to employ the commercialists to control the workers. we look at the statement about the Bhagavad Gita, we see that all beings who bend the knee are people, and yet the only really people are those physical knee benders, the workers. And they are actually kept in terror in primitive societies by the threat of castration. It used to be customary to make the statement very, very openly, and you find it in the word testament still extant. When a man swore that he would undertake something, he swore, "If I do not fulfill this, you may remove my testicles. I am not worthy to generate." This is called a testament. It's Etim Davim Skeet, but you can find it in respectable dictionaries. When the workers are frightened physically by this, they just concentrate like mad on doing what work they are forced to do and nipping out in odd moments to find a girlfriend and spending their evenings in making whoopee as much as possible. The clerks, on the other hand, are so terrified of being reduced to that level that they try to fulfill the conditions laid upon them by the individual power men, the head men. And so the clerks accept education. They learn to read and write and do arithmetic, and they try to pass their 11 pluses in order to avoid being classed as knee-bending workers. But they are still knee-benders, and knee-benders to the head men above them. And the individual head men above them, the prime ministers and the Khrushchevs and the Kennedys and such like people, are under the advice of the priests who claim to know something about the way cosmos runs. But the priests are bending the knee also. You even see an archbishop bend the knee before the altar of the absolute. And he bends the knee to this concept of universal reason in order to impose on the individual power man, in order that he will impose on the commercialist, in order that he will impose on the worker. This is a hierarchy. Now, beyond this social system, this four-caste system, there is no thing, no finite, there is the absolute. And the man who aims to be reflexively self-conscious is aiming to turn consciousness back onto itself, to release it from any objectification whatever, so that the consciousness that turns out of the worker identification into the clerk has escaped the lower knee-bending working level and identified with the clerk. The clerk who realizes that if you learn more you might become a headman breaks identification with the clerk level and gets a business of his own. The individual man who realizes that there is another level above of cosmic knowledge might claim to have it and become a Hitler or a Mussolini or a Napoleon, and he tries to join the priests. We get Big Charlie and the Holy Roman material empire formulated by such men. Each time they climb out from a lower level, they break identification by identifying with a higher level. You break the worker, you become a clerk. You break the clerk concept, you become an individual self-made man. You break this concept and you join the cosmic priesthood. If you break this concept, you are free. You have no concept whatever. You are merely a pure consciousness identified with no form. And in so becoming, you are factually free of all the concepts below. If you are really free of them, you won't go about telling them that you are free of them, because they won't like it. They'll think you are ignoring their principles, refusing to worship their gods. You remember that Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego refused to bend the knee to an idol and therefore were put in a fiery furnace. The fiery furnace referred to is the furnace of spirit. Spirit is represented anciently by fire. And either you identify with a finite form and therefore worship an idol, or you go into the fiery furnace. If you've got the nerve to go into the fiery furnace, you'll find an angel is with you in magical parlance, this is your holy guardian angel, which is simply your own self at the point of reflexive awareness. You discover that you can sense this within the notion, which is absolute energy. The Gita says that out of thousands, not one tries to become perfect. But out of the perfect, not one actually gains the goal. If we say out of the workers, we know that they don't strive for perfection at all. They just strive to get through the day, you know, to get off, to get a pint on the way home, get a quick working out again. The clerks are striving to maintain the position. That's called keeping up with the Joneses. And the headmen are striving to maintain their position. Now, some men who consider themselves perfect, because perfect means perfect, perfect, are claiming to be aware of cosmic logos, of universal reason. And they would call themselves the perfect, and the Gita is referring to these men as perfect. They say, we know the rules. And yet, funnily enough, they're still identified with cosmic logic. There's something they haven't done. Or to be more accurate, there's nothing they haven't done. And until they do the nothing, they haven't finished their work. The word perfection is from fakere, to make or do, and the PR root, which implies reason. But, as Heraclitus pointed out, reason is an energy formulating. When energy moves along, it can move either rotating or not. If it moves without rotating, it never encloses a zone. But if after moving along for a certain distance it goes round, in the act of going round and getting hold of itself, tail in mouth, it has rationalized and formulated itself. It's formulated itself. The energy has now become involved in the formal system. In the act of rotating, it has gone under the law of pi ratio. It has gone under the law of ratio, that one thing is related to another thing formally, and that this is expressible mathematically and geometrically. Expressible in scientific terms, mathematically and geometrically. So that the man who says, oh, I know the thing, I am perfect in this sense, my conceptual mechanism is logical. And given the appropriate data, it will always come to a right conclusion. And therefore, I am perfect. He means I am rationally doing. I am acting rationally. And yet the Gita says that these perfect, there may be 1,000 perfect, and yet not one may attain what perfection is about. Each man, when he tries to transcend, does so for a purpose. He's trying to get out of a limitation imposed upon his will. The worker may try to climb out and aspire to be a clerk, the clerk to be a self-made businessman, he to be a cosmic representative or priest or divine king. But when he gets to the priest level, if he's not careful, he will start resting on his laurels. He'll be satisfied with the formulation. He now has below him the headmen, the clerks, and the workers, all under his control. This makes a peculiar cycle where he's giving orders, and the orders are going down, producing modifications, and the feedback from the orders given gives him another problem to solve. He is trapped within formal manifestation. Most men who are perfect in the sense that they have logical machines at work are so self-satisfied with their rationalizing processes that they think it is enough. That's a decision they make. But if they are satisfied to remain as big chief within cosmos, utilizing cosmic law and acting rationally in conformity with it, they have not completed the purpose of evolution. PR is the root of pi ratio. And if we spell it with a Y instead of an I, it spells pi which is the Greek word for fire. Now Heraclitus said that the logos of the universe is an energy. This energy formulates. Now the formulator tends to forget that the form is willed by the energy. Spirit wills form. So he tends to stretch the existing form of the universe. So that he tends to go into a cosmic rut. He keeps going round obeying the cosmic cycle. If there had been only that type of perfect man, then we would still be in the stage of social evolution of old Babylon. We wouldn't have bothered to move, because we would have said the stars in their courses have fixed patterns, and by studying them we can conform exactly to them, and this is life. This is exactly what the Asiatically originating Greek Stoic philosophy said. They said the universe is a logos, a formal structure. We understand this and therefore behave rationally. And the great man is the man who behaves rationally in conformity with cosmic law. And by cosmic law they meant this wheel of energies formulated as the sidereal system, the solar system, the planetary system, and so on. Everything was obedient to existing form. There are some other men who have no regard for this form, and even in the scientific sense, they're determined to blast everything to bits, shift the sun from where it is and put it somewhere else, put some stars out and make some new ones. This is not obeying the cosmic law that was set up. It's obeying something which is no law and yet is a law. Law means that which is laid down, and the law maker is the energy that lays itself down. So when it says of the perfect, perhaps one in a thousand, or not one in a thousand might make it, it means that when you have reached the level of cosmic awareness that there is a logical cosmic structure, if you stop there you still haven't completed the cycle. You haven't turned your pi ratio, your reason, into the fiery energy that generated it. And therefore you have not completed your reflexive cycle. If you examine yourself very carefully, when you are reasoning, you will find impelling your reason is energy. If you're reasoning very tightly, you'll find there's a lot of energy behind it making you do so. You have a purpose. A purpose is something set before you for realization. And pushing it is your will. Your will is trying to get somewhere when it is reasoning. The reason is only a tool for the will. If the reason sets up a form, and the form then imposes on the will has duped itself with its own creation. And therefore, even with the very highest forms, the perfect form of the sphere, the man who is duped by this sphere to conform to it rationally has missed his real aim, which is to rediscover the creativity of his own will. So shortly we can say that we don't expect people as such as the knee benders to work for perfection, for perfect rationality, but those beings who do attain a perfectly rational machine in the mind, when they've organized their mind so that it always works rationally, of those it is very unlikely that one of them will break out from the thousand perfect and gain that which is above this perfect form, namely the free will. If we were to build the structure of the four men again, the workers, the clerks, the headmen and the priests, and the invisible, if we applied to this one of the yoga doctrines, we put earth down here, and then we put the water, and then we put the fire, and then we put the air, and on the top, the invisible is the quintessence, the fifth essence. In yoga parlance, that's the Akasha. Akasha means this invisible, which is necessarily at the back of the fourfold facts we see in the world. We see solid bodies, we see a body liquefied, we see the same body with further heat turn into a gas, we see the same gas become incandescent and radiate away as energy. So we see four phases of being in the universe, and these four, because they change, must be modalities of something that we do not see. This which we do not see is the essence, called the quintessence, the fifth essence. If we like to do a diagram of the Earth and say, there's the Earth, and round it there is an aquasphere, a sphere of water. It might have been grouped together in certain deep holes in the Earth to make seas, where the mountains are stuck up, and so on. But there's a geosphere, the Earth, and an aquasphere, the water around it, or the hydrosphere, as some say, prefer in the Greek. And around this hydrosphere there's an atmosphere, and around this there is another sphere, the sphere of electromagnetic energies, the ionosphere, and so on. We have the Earth solid, the water around it, the air around it, and the heat around that, and all these in constant interplay. The animating principle of this is the heat. It moves the air, it moves the water, it moves the earth. And beyond these is that field in which these four have appeared. Now, so far, the scientists have done quite a lot of measurement with their Sputniks and other devices to measure electromagnetic belts around the earth. They've done the hydrosphere, the geosphere, the atmosphere. In recent years, in the last 10 years, they've done quite a lot in the electromagnetic fields around the Earth, but beyond these they have done very, very little. They're beginning to find, between the Earth and the Moon, that they can get readings of fields, gravitational fields. These are really the overlappings from the electromagnetic belts around the Earth and the Moon and so on. They're doubtful about whether Venus has one. If they don't get a reading, they might think it hasn't got one, because they will have to introduce the concept of a standing field that gives no reading on an instrument. It is still a field. In between all these planets, there is that which has condensed to form this ionosphere and this atmosphere and this hydrosphere and this geosphere. That was there before these condensations occurred, and it will be there when they dissolve. And this is the fifth. This is the quintessence of being. And the man who's aware of that is unformulated and absolute. He doesn't bend the knee to any form at all. He bends the knee to nothing. His own being is initiative, it is energy, and he doesn't even bend the knee to himself. So that, the word Jew, which means the mysterious perfection of God himself, is used as a name for people that can even contradict themselves. They're not even bound by their own opinions about anything whatever. We do not expect beings who are pursuing security to transcend form. Because as long as they're pursuing security, they have an idea that they're finite. And they have an idea that a formulation can protect them. And so they aim at it. In the case of the worker, he aims the roof over his head and one or two little appendages to it. And that is enough. The clerk requires slightly more, and the hetman requires a bit more, and the priest requires a bit more. They're still under the canopy of heaven, and they still feel fairly safe within their definitions, within their formulations. But beyond this, the quintessential being is unformed. He doesn't want to be secured at all. He wants to be free, and he knows that secure means tied up, locked up. That S has gone into K, spirit has gone into bondage, to gain security, so he prefers to be free from security. This doesn't stop him going inside somebody else's house if it's raining, but it does mean that he is not dependent on the formulation. The quickest way to the quintessential or reflexive level is just to give up the idea of individual security. Because it's the quickest way, it's therefore the hardest way. Because a shortcut requires a terrific amount of energy to make the leap. But the way to it is to realize that these four levels do bend the knee, so that once a person has understood the level of the physical knee benders, the polloi, he doesn't like to think of himself as down at that level, so he might start learning to read and write to avoid being pushed around. Some of you might have seen some gypsies being interviewed last night and saying, we don't like being pushed about and we don't like having nowhere to put our caravans, and if we go for jobs to the Ministry of Labour, the first thing they say is, can you read and write? And we say no, and then they won't employ us. Because they couldn't read or write, they are being pushed about. As cities grow, there's less and less common land free for the gypsy mentality to camp on. When one of these young gypsies was asked, can't you get a job at all, being unable to read or write? He said, yes, I could go as a labourer, but that is hard work. And the interviewer said, but other people have to do hard work? And he said, yes, but I'm not used to hard work. We've been dodging it. Now, compassion by broad-minded city dwellers might give them a green plot to put their caravans on. But if it does, it's entirely an act of mercy on the part of kind-hearted citizens if they get one. And there are a lot of people who think they shouldn't exist at all, because they contribute nothing whatever except a picturesque figure passing across the landscape to the social structure. Because of the law of the inequality of finites, I would say keep them like you would keep a few lions and tigers and rhinos for Prince Philip to chase after. Keep one of each at least, or two if they have to breed. Certainly, we see that they are pushed about. And when you realize that you will be pushed about as long as you bend the knee to certain stimuli, the tendency may arise in you to try to climb out. If you haven't a lot of energy or clarity, you might not remember it tomorrow. You might remember it 5 years' time when you go to a good play on a friend's TV set, because you've never been able to afford the money yourself, because the brewer got it. If you become a clerk, you discover that you can be ordered about. You might even become redundant at the will of the boss, who might decide to shift the whole thing from Liverpool back to Dagenham or wherever it is. Each time you get an impulse to try to climb out. But if you can't remember what you're climbing out of tomorrow, your decision might lapse till next year. In fact, it might not recur again unless somebody hits you very hard. And so climbing out from each level is very hard. If you become an individual hetman, climbing out of the sense of power, of being a self-made figure, especially if you've received a title for your demonstration, can be very hard. But if you do manage to climb out of this thing, maybe you're too old yourself, but you realize with the money you've got, you could educate one of your children to be the Archbishop of Canterbury, or if you're lucky, the Pope. If he climbs out, you could say, he's fulfilling my purpose. He's gone beyond self-made man, and he's now entirely supported by a universal principle. But if he gets locked in that level, he's still entirely subordinate to the free movement of spirit outside that might suddenly remove the whole thing. It's not very, very long ago, I think, what was it, 1929, the year of the Wall Street crash, when Vatican City got itself 100 acres of ground. The Italian government had stolen Rome from them in the previous century. After centuries of supreme authority, they were reduced down to a little park of their own. We can never tell where that spirit is going to hit next, because it is free, it is unformulated, it is not determined, it is not predictable. The symbol in the tower of Pack, if you remember, is the tower. Out of this tower, two men are falling. One is a pope and the other is a king. The powers spiritual and the powers temporal. Coming out of the sky, there is lightning. Who knows where the lightning is going to strike? Nobody. You may put your lightning conductors up, and it doesn't mean that it's going to hit the conductor and not your building. It may. Statistics and probability give people a feeling of security. But even if the lightning misses you there, if it decides to come underneath and shake your foundations, you're still for it. There is no guarantee whatever of continued existence for any formulated being. And therefore the only immortal level is the level of non-formulation. To be identified with no thing whatever is to be quintessential and to be reflexive. You turn back the spirit that entered into this process, created the four cats, and you go back. One of the significances of the sign of Taurus. You go in and you go out. If you remember that if there is an in, there is an out. If there is a finite, there is an infinite, and so on. And you prefer, like Abel did, the infinite. And having learned the lesson of Abel, you may not sacrifice in the presence of Cain, because he doesn't like it. The canny man, if he thinks you're being absolute, will be very upset. The perfectionist will be very upset. You're not bending the knee to his forms. And he has climbed out from below to release himself from the orders coming to him from above. At each level he's climbed out, he has an idea growing in his mind that someday he will give the orders to everybody. He will be a big priest, if possible, after the order of Melchizedek, and he will tell you what to do.
In the Indian Dharma concept, is that a means of imposing this upon people? Or, at its highest level, it says if a being becomes what he is, it's that concept, isn't it? Does and becomes what he is.
Yes.
And he can achieve the way of truth or the light itself.
Mm-hmm.
But I see this from the priest level, from the Brahmin level, as an imposition, isn't it? Saying you are a worker and this is your job and this you must accept.
Oh yes, because we know that the absolute truth, when it has filtered through in the form of myth or religious system, has been abused.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, the statement is true that if a man who is at the worker level bending the knee, if he could see through it and see that this knee bending is a function of universal spirit and this is precipitated by the absolute, he could actually be free in his act. He could reinterpret the act. He could still chase the girl in the park. And he could see it as a play of spiritual energies.
Needing that experience, I'm doing that as part of
yes, as part of the cycle and as part of the hierarchy. If he did that, then he would not be bound by it. But the general test of that is, are you doing it by inclination? If by inclination you are not at the level where you are doing it freely, there is a bias in the body. And if you don't want to pull your own leg, then you test yourself by inclination. And if you can do without it completely, then, and not before, are you really doing it freely when you do it? So when it says in the concept of Dharma, which means law of being, and the statement is made that every being fulfills the law of its own being, it is better for a worm to worm about efficiently than for it to come out and declare itself to be an eagle and get gobbled up. If it fulfills that function adequately and reflexively, its joy is as great as the eagle's. And if it's doing it by inclination only, it is under the cosmic law. The whole test is, are we passive or active in a stimulus situation? If the stimulus determines our behavior, we are in bondage. If the stimulus cannot force us to behave in any way at all, then what we do is a free act. And it doesn't matter what we do, because matter is a modality of spirit. It is spirit materializing. And to be non-dualistic, it does not matter in any way, nor does the spirit in any way, unless you put a will stress upon it. And if your will is free, there are no values to you other than those created by your own will.
How would you break this level from being nearly involved within it? Would it be this means of universalizing it eventually? As we once did say with the road sweeper, or any particular activity whatsoever.
You mean break it when you're actually doing a low-level dharma?
Saying you took somebody at that level, it's all right. They've worked for generations, perhaps, at this particular level. Bricklaying or
yeah.
A labouring job even more than that.
Yeah.
At a certain point, there's a break through that job where they see that not that there's something beyond it, like, say, the clerk level, but that this dharma function is actually functioning. And they break through and do become reflexively self-conscious. Where would the breakthrough occur there? Would it be
where they saw energy to be all there was in the environment? You remember Brother Lawrence does this, doesn't he? He sees some dead trees with no leaves on them, it is winter. Then he remembers that in the spring there will be leaves like there were last year. So he knows there is energy there, and that in its time it will come out. So if you see the material situation as merely a formulation of energy, and you get hold of your own energy, your will, then you are at one with the situation. And whatever you do, you are released from it.
But you don't need to strive above that then, do you?
No, there is no above it.
No, you recognize that you could achieve anything.
Of course,
yes.
Because all is spirit.
Yeah.
The Jivan Mukta in yoga philosophy is the free in life. Free one is alive. Jivan means individual self, and Moksha means freedom. You are free while you're still an individual, providing you see your individuality as pure spirit, pure energy. The form that is there is only energy formulating. There's no duality. There isn't a material world. And the spiritual world elsewhere, waiting for you to abandon the material world to find it, which is here and now. Francis Thompson puts it, turn but a stone and start to wing. You see, there's an angel under every stone, actually in the stone. He says, our world invisible, we view it. Inapprehensible, we clutch it. It's not a figure of speech. I hold a pencil in my hand, and if I think it's a material object, other than spirit, I'm deceived. But if I think that this pencil is a modality of spirit, then the pencil itself is a spiritual entity. And then I don't need to go away to the Himalayas and meditate to find spirit like Tyrone Power did on one occasion, because I can see it in the pencil. And the whole thing is an interpretation. You're in a situation, and the way you interpret it, and nothing else, conditions how that situation acts upon you and how you react. The primitive mentality of the pantheists saw the wind as a willful spirit deliberately blowing his hair up at the back, and he saw a stone falling down onto his foot as malicious, intending to hurt him. That was his interpretation. We today interpret it, the stone doesn't know where it's falling, it's just going down towards the centre of the earth, and it's our business to remove the foot. At each level we reinterpret, we release ourselves from the previous formulation. So that daily reinterpretation is essential to avoid getting into a formal groove about how to look at the world. Well, we'd use daily in the original sense of day means any division whatever. Moment. A moment in engineering, a turning moment, a moment of reorientation. That should be going on continuously.
This is the breaking identification in the now all the time.
You see, supposing somebody said, oh, I have heard vaguely in an article by Aldous Huxley that there is a heaven land which one can attain through mescaline if one can get some, and there's a slightly longer way by yoga practice, and say, what's the shortest way to get there? And you say, oh, the method called assumption. What's that? Assume you're there, and now act as if you were there. How do you act if you're there? What do you do if you've already attained your absoluteness? Ask yourself, and then do it. It's really as simple as that. But think how much energy you need to get together, to focus in a now existential where you are, and say, now how did the absolute act? Imagine man on the second level, and scraping his pen in the book, and it suddenly occurs in his mind, how did the absolute act at this point? He's writing in this book. There are so many things open to it, anything could happen. And he becomes free at this moment. What's the weather like? Sunshiny? Very pleasant. What's the atmosphere like in this office? Pretty horrid. Not enough oxygen. I know. I'll go and see the boss and tell him we need more oxygen. Now, he could do this. And he could get away with it. He could actually cause the boss to produce an oxygen machine. I know a particular case where this actually happened. And he got an oxygen machine. But he has to realize what the absolute would do in that situation, and then, overthrowing all his inertias and fears, get up and go and do it. And the moment he does it, he is free. That's called the short way. Zen is about that same thing. Zen does it negatively. It says, inhibit all the things you know about yourself and keep on inhibiting it. In the archery thing, hold the bow and wait for the arrow to shoot. How much stamina have you got? It's a negative way. The other way is the shorter way than the immediate way of Zen. It's even immediate. Ask yourself, what would the absolute do? And the answer is anything. Then why are you doing this particular thing? That's inertia. Well, break it. Doesn't matter what you do, get up and go out and spend the day in the cinema. And then decide whether you'll go back or not. When you've been. Maybe you won't want to see the program. Maybe it's a lousy program. So you go elsewhere. But to do this, you have to break the inertia of the self-protection of your individual vehicle. So although it's the short way, and is the shortest way, and it's the simplest way, it is not easy because of the inertias. But when you realize there aren't anything other than inertias to overcome, then you spend your time overcoming inertias. The word that the Gita uses for these perfected, enlightened beings, Siddhi and Siddha, you can tell by the use of the D's inside it that it is an analytical word. The S symbolizes spirit, and the D symbolizes analysis. So it's perfectly obvious why the Gita says these perfected, these Siddhi men, are quite probably going to miss it, because they are formulators, they're analyzers. The absolute does not analyze. And of those who have analyzed right to the top of the cosmic principle, then it is likely to say, now we will jump beyond analysis.
This is why there's a tremendous difficulty in this particular interpretation of Prasgov, because the book itself is interpreted by the very men
who are perfect in a sense.
Yes.
You remember Charlton Heston didn't suffer from this sort of thing, did he?
They say it's terribly hard to interpret that saying. It's very widely
you can't interpret that saying unless you are pitched outside form. Otherwise you would have to rationalise it within your conceptual structure.
You must justify your own position.
You can't see beyond it. Because they would say, how can we think about it without thinking about it? And the answer is, you can't. So give up. But if we give up thinking, there's nothing there. That's a good point. Precisely by this nothing, we can do something. Which is the meaning of the Tao Te Ching. Yoga philosophy says this simple thing is so difficult that you should spend all your time sweeping away the rubbish that stops you doing it. It has it in the perfectly charming illustration that the yogi sits like a lamp flame in a windless place. He's not perturbed. This flame is self-reflexive awareness. It does nothing. Stimuli come and it doesn't flicker. He's attained the thing in reflexiveness. And he's not formulated. The concept we've had before of the candle, the wick and the flame. What is happening, it says, as the smith refines silver, so do the wise men find away their defilements. The silversmith, of course, is the mind. Clean and upper. The mind's metal is silver. The silversmith boils this metal and lets it settle, and a scum comes on top. He removes it. He does it again. Another scum comes. He does it again. He keeps on doing it. He does it 7 times. And he takes the scum off each time, and then he's got his refined silver. The mind with the rubbish removed from it. Now all the rubbish that appears in the mind appears for us at our level serially. If we dare to watch our thoughts without criticism, just without criticism, look at them, we will be literally amazed at the profound rubbish that goes through the mind. Love decalities, stupidities, resentments, hates, angers, sentimentalities. Nothing but a continuous stream of entirely valueless stuff. This is called watching the monkey jump. The mind is a kind of monkey. Monkey is key to the man. This mind just talks twice continuously. If you watch it to become convinced of this fact, you finally give it up. You say, oh, what a horrible thing to depend on. But if you don't watch it, if you only look at it when you get a good idea, and you say, good gracious, that's a good idea, and it is mine, then you've got trouble. Look at the other times when you don't get that brilliant idea and see what you're up to. Which is about nearly 100% of your time. The mind is churning out rubbish. So you have to say, I'm getting rid of the rubbish. Now boiling this silver, boiling the mind, is the same thing as getting annoyed. It is the anger, the heat, that is generated in you by opposition that boils your mind. And this is where, if you're a very smart fellow, you'll employ a boiler. That is somebody to annoy you. Because without this annoyance, you cannot become aware of the parts of the mind that are really stirring up this rubbish. Opposition is true friendship. Get somebody to insult you and see how your mind reacts. And don't waste time looking at him. Look at your own reaction. You find the mind is full of rubbish. Eventually you become convinced that the mind is rubbish. Now this candle, when it is burning, is like Brother Cain. Call it Cain's doll, if you like. There's a wick in it. The word wick means quick. That's like your spinal cord. It's your consciousness, like a flame there. And as it's burning, the wax of this candle is going down. It's funny that it's called wax, but it wanes as you burn it. It's the flame, of course, that waxes, and the wax is called wax because it wanes and makes the flame wax. As your body is progressively being purified, the elements that were hidden in unconscious and subconscious processes in the body appear as wisdom, as consciousness. But they won't do unless you set fire to the body. And the only way you can set fire to the body is by annoying it. and most bodies are so adequately defended against self-annoyance that the only effective way is to get a friend to annoy you. It's really terribly important, this thing about being annoyed and watching your mind. If you could have, say, two or three days, two or three evenings a week, just sitting in a circle saying rude things to each other. It is actually a good thing. It doesn't matter if somebody abuses it and starts being rude for what they would internally feel is just venom. They've always wanted to do this exercise. It doesn't matter at all about this. It's how the individual receives it. This is for every individual to take the annoyance and switch the attention off this man, because he never did annoy you in any case. He knows nothing about you. He merely shot one of his arrows. If you have a tender spot, examine your tender spot. Very, very good exercise. I recommend it. It's quite a good idea to pay each other, incidentally, in presents for very good annoyances for which illumination was done. One Mars bar shall be awarded for every bitterness felt. No, seriously, it's a good way to do it. No final question. How about you, Joss?
I have just so much to think about and work out, I couldn't ask a question. Seeing how much I can annoy Arthur.
Why have you inverted only five in this particular number?
Why have I? Because in this particular caste system diagram, the airmen actually consider themselves superior to the pound. You see, the airmen in India, the Brahmins, place themselves on top. And for a long time, by their airy tricks, they duped the individuals to be subordinate to them.
Not just power members.
No, they were actually hairy men who were formerly Christians, and the energy men were too busy to stop them. So they imposed on the clerks and the workers, and they utilized the tendency of firemen to go out and fight. And if the firemen liked to do this, they actually encouraged them to make armies and go and knock somebody off in an adjacent territory. And for a long time, this was quite all right. But when the units of society got bigger and bigger, gradually the firemen realized that they'd only been doing what they wanted to do when they went out fighting, and that the stay-at-home airmen had in fact been consolidating their positions, so that when the military leaders had been out and conquered something and came back and wanted glory, they found that the men who were giving permission for the celebration were airmen who had not fought. This is like the blessing of great warriors by archbishops and so on. At a certain point, the firemen said, these men have no power at all. They just consolidate their position with logic and words while they're out fighting. But they really can't fight. And they rose up one night and they usurped the position. And they severely threatened the airmen, the priests, and said, now, if you do not bless us with the blessing of your universal logical God, in public where people can see it and say we are divine, we will cut your heads off. And at that moment they inverted the thing. And the firemen went on top, and the divine right of kings was born. you remember in the ambiguous case of that is M and A, isn't it? Well, when it's inconvenient for him to be subordinate to the Pope on account of the divorce he needs, and some money invested in the monasteries, and he doesn't see any reason why he should go to Rome, he just asserts himself, breaks with the papacy, and declares himself head of the church. He's a farmer. He said, well, you've had your bit of fun. As long as it's convenient for me to do it, all right. But I know you have no power, except the power conferred upon you by a loose tongue. And I too can develop one of those. And she does. So he becomes not only king, but head of the church. And humanly enough, still remained Catholic in faith. He wasn't a Protestant. Thereby, he was quite right to take all the money out of the monastery. It was his. That was a typical example in England of the same thing that happened in India. The firemen got fed up with the airmen rationalising their wages for them and took over. And then they employed the rationalisers to justify what they wanted to do next, which is the position of all established religions. Now, the established church in any country is there to give universal or divine blessing on whatever the king wants to do.
Are the airmen back on top now?
No.
Western countries?
No. No, they'll never get on top again. It was only in an early stage of human evolution that they could get on top, when the firemen were out there and the world was big enough to chase about.
But that had been about the period of Germany. Where would you place the great men, the great men concept that we were speaking about the other week?
The headman concept.
Yes, you know, in Taurus, they would, but what would you call those hetmans? They were definitely active men, weren't they?
Oh, yes, they were active men. They were active
Indian
making decisions and assuming responsibilities without any ground other than they willed to do it.
They'd taken over then, had they, from the airmen, or
yes.
Did the airmen come later than that?
No, the airmen were in the general.
Would be in the general, yes.
Before that, everybody in council was intuitive. You couldn't do much with them at all. When you went to cats and the taxes, they left on an intuition. It's all very charming.